Hello there, and a very good morning to you. You're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning, and for a change, we'll start with the headlines in the British papers today, because certainly for next week there's going to be little else except Brexit and May and our future and all that. So the Observer says Cabinet splits over second referendum on Brexit deal, and the Sunday Telegraph, May losing grip as party is rocked by resignations. So they're all very confused about, and there are hints that she won't have the vote on Tuesday and that she's going to look for something more from Europe. But from our own headlines, the UK Brexit Secretary Stephen Barclay has said Tuesday's House of Commons vote on Theresa May's Brexit deal will definitely go ahead. So that's it so far. Now, closer to home, Sunday Independent. Varadkar holds firm but ready to listen. And there's a story about Graham Dwyer and his case during the week on the front page. We come on to the Business Post. Investigations into I&M data deepens after computers of editors interrogated at night. The Sunday Times, May heading for Brussels in last bid to save deal. Nuns drag feet on hospital deal. That's a story by Justine McCarthy with further inside. And Minister raps RTE for taking out reporter Fitzgerald. Now, moving over to the tabs, the Sunday World, my hell, this is about a victim's of a horror assault and how they're treated as victims. The Irish Sun on Sunday, Kinahan thug dies falling off hotel, and the Mail, backlash over, in inverted commas, demotion of RTE's Martina, and an angry minister talking about it, and RTE's response is that it was an open competition. So let me introduce you, if I may, to our guest this morning. Seamus Coffey's lecturer of economics at UCC and chair of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council. Irene Sands, barrister, specialised in criminal law. Dennis Staunton, London editor with the Irish Times. Dr. Niamh Howrigan, sociologist, and Eddie Malloy, management consultant and member of Sloan2Care Implementation Advisory Council. And you are all most welcome indeed. I mentioned it in the headlines there, Niamh, it was Justine McCarthy's article about the National Maternity Hospital. Yeah.
There's a whole series of articles in the papers today looking at both the National Maternity Hospital issue and the introduction of abortion services issue. And I think at the outset, it's important to recognise that they are different but related issues, because I think they're getting conflated in ways that are actually unhelpful and are stalling things and making things perhaps more problematic than they need to be. And of course, Justine McCarthy's article is very detailed and goes through the history of the emergence of agreements between the various parties involved around the maternity hospital issue. Yeah. And the perception now that there is a kind of a stalling for some reason. Now, I suppose it's important to recognise why this is so urgent, is that if it doesn't kick in essentially before the end of the year, because of new EU regulations, the whole plan will have to go back to the drawing board after Christmas if this isn't passed by the new year. So there is a sense of urgency about it. Again, some of the kind of history that she highlights, you know, teases through the complexities of the relationships between the various religious orders and the institutional actors involved. And again, there's a follow-on from what Rona O'Mahony said on this programme yesterday. But for me, the upshot of it all is two things. First of all, given the urgency of the situation, it would appear that there is a working agreement in place. It wouldn't appear that there is a massive sense of objection around this public interest director, which was, I suppose, suppose. And again, that was the follow-on from the referendum, which seemed to kind of throw a bit of a new element in the mix. But there doesn't seem to be a massive objection there. Secondly, structurally, it would appear, and I'm not a company lawyer, just that I'm open to correction on this, but the basis of the new maternity hospital will be as a company rather than as a charity. So therefore, it will in effect be run in line with the laws of the land. I suppose the reason I think that there's such jitteriness about it is because of, I suppose, the legacies of all the conflict that went on this year around these particular issues.
Well, and not only that, but the history going back over decades of women interacting with the Catholic Church all the things and all the scandals that emerged.
Exactly. Yeah. And when you're in a scenario where something is in process and not complete, and this would appear to be, it's very easy for all of that. It's almost like a trauma point. It comes back up for people. And then it's hard when key figures in the area come out and say, look, trust this. This is okay, it's going to happen. It's hard for people to accept that.
Well, they're worried.
They're worried, exactly. Yeah. And there's a lot of anxiety around this. But it would seem to me that given the state that the process is in, given the risks of letting it go beyond Christmas, there comes a point in these trust anxiety nexuses where people have to step out on the ice and just hope for the best. And it seems to me that we're at this point with this issue. And, you know, I think that's where the nerve has to hold.
Well, there seems to be, there is a difference between what Rona O'Mahony was saying yesterday and what people that were protesting, shall we say, in Dublin yesterday believe. So we got on, we got back over what Rona said to us, that the Sisters of Charity, quote, have transferred the land, the assets, all elements of ownership into new companies, and the constitution of these was before the charity's regulator. This is all happening and in process, and under the terms of this, St. Vincent's Healthcare Group will be a company, a normal company under Irish law. There's absolutely no involvement either in land, in shareholding, in any element by the Sisters of Charity. And this is the factual position, is what she said. And when I asked her, do the nuns need permission from Archbishop Martin or the Vatican to divest themselves? She said the Sisters of Charity can take advice, but they don't need permission. And this is all direct quotes from her. But the divestment is well underway. People will have to accept this is happening. The constitution for the companies has been written. The Sisters of Charity have nothing to do with the new National Maternity Hospital. Now, both of these comments have attracted a lot of comment in the newspaper, and we sought clarity on them this morning. And a spokesperson for the National Maternity Hospital has said, we have been told that the constitutions are written and ready to be submitted, and will give effect to what the Sisters of Charity clearly said they would do 18 months ago. And on the question of permissions, they said, well, while this is not our issue, we understand that the Sisters of Charity have no outstanding requirement for permission or advice from any church authorities in order to give effect to the decision they announced 18 months ago. And by the way, just to clear everything out of the way, when we were talking about it, I mentioned Peter Boylan yesterday, that he welcomed the Sisters of Charity statement last year that they were ending their involvement with St. Vincent's. But on the question of governance, as the board of the new hospital isn't in place, he said he has not approved because he doesn't know what it is, which is perfectly reasonable. You're a man for keeping a sharp eye on governance and all of that, Eddie Malloy, and obviously you're involved in Sláinte Care. There's this terrible kind of weighing up that one has to do. We don't want to land in a mess of church-state rows over what's happening in the maternity hospital, but we really do need the hospital.
Yeah, I mean, Rona Mahoney also, in one of her very, very crystal clear statements, said this is separation of church and state. End of story.
Yeah.
And I think Niamh has crystallised what's at issue here. And if I could put it this way, is do we trust the nuns? I mean, that's what it boils down to.
A lot of people
don't.
And that's very unfair on the particular women involved.
Well, absolutely, and there's a long history, chewing babies and mother and
all of that.
All of that has kind of washed up on the shores of this particular discussion. It would seem to me that there's probably no institution in the state has been, that its governance structures have been put through the ringer as much as these have.
Yeah.
And it really does boil down to whether or not you can bring yourself to trust the nuns given all that has happened. Because as things stand right now, everything is set up. And if you'd like, ready to be signed, but it hasn't been. And people are saying, but I'm not going to trust.
I'm not going to step on the ice, to use that image.
I'm not going to step on the ice until I'm going to stay on dry land until I see it signed in blood. And that's where we are. Now, the price you pay for that is that it delays the start-up of the hospital. And it could delay it for years.
Years,
and inflate the cost, as Ronan Mahoney said yesterday. And I think that those who have the decisions to make, i.e. the minister in this case, if that's what's holding him back, the trust issue, they should go ahead and do it and sort it out later on if there's a glitch in it. I think that public opinion, the changes in Ireland, in the fabric of society, simply would not tolerate any after-the-event intrusion by the nuns or any last-minute
sleight of hand, three-card trick
to kind of retrieve their role in the church, in the hospital.
Dennis Daunton, what do you think?
I think that I agree with that. It is a question of the balance of risks, and I thought that Ronan Mahoney made a very persuasive case for the idea that actually there wouldn't be any religious involvement or influence over treatment there. But as Eddie says, the difficulty is that until you have it all signed, sealed and delivered, many people are going to just doubt it. And you would, I think, I mean, it is certainly true because of the religious thing, but I think you would in any big decision that you make, if you're being told you've got to hurry up, there's a deadline in a couple of weeks, you know, it's all going to be fine, then I think there is a bit of anxiety. But having said that, clearly the cost of waiting is potentially very great, both in terms just of time and of money.
I don't think we have the option of waiting, Marianne, if I can be honest. We are bound to a deadline by the end of this year in terms of the plans that have already been submitted and approved and for which there's funding for. And Minister Harris is the only person who is needed to sign off on two particular contracts, one in relation to the pharmacy and one in relation to the car park, for the commencement of those buildings. If they don't get signed off before the end of the year, we're not compliant with new EU directives in relation to energy. It's in relation to energy efficiency. These buildings will be energy efficient regardless, but there's new guidelines in place. These plans are actually under a 2006 guideline. If it's not signed off and commenced before the end of the year, we are back, as Niamh said, we are back to square one. We have to go back to the drawing board. The plans have to be amended. They have to be resubmitted to On Board Planála. And aside from the cost implications that will add to a project that is already inflated in cost, the timeline, it really could scupper the entire project. And the minister has serious questions to consider in terms of whether he wants to put the public air of mistrust and the sisters and the question over whether they'll be involved, which seems to have been settled as far as I can see 18 months ago. This hospital is going to be run in accordance with the law of the land as a company. There's going to be no ethos or influence.
You were talking to Nicholas Kearns, I gather, yesterday.
I happened to encounter former Judge Kearns, yes. And he was very much emphatic that this is going to be run in accordance with the laws of the land, regardless of any ethos, and that positions in relation to boards or governance is something to be decided at a much later stage, because there could be people that will be very appropriate for the board that aren't even on the radar as it currently stands, and we're a long way off the hospital even being built, never mind deciding who takes appointments or positions.
Yeah, but it is important to know what the balance would be in terms of a board, even if nobody has been chosen.
And who appoints them.
Yeah.
Absolutely, but I think what's much more important at this juncture, given the time sensitivity, is that we get the project off the ground. And there's a real risk of that not happening if Minister Harris doesn't sign those two contracts before the end of the year. There'll be no board to talk about.
We'll just come back to, again, to repeat what the spokesperson said this morning about the constitutions are written and ready to be submitted. You'd love to shove them in the door.
You'd have to ask the question, why is the minister holding back? Mm-hmm. Is the minister holding back because he doesn't trust the nuns? Or why else might he be? And see, one of the more disturbing things in the interview yesterday was Ronan Mahoney saying that once she took action against the government, they wouldn't meet her for months. You know, taking umbrage at the idea of taking him to court.
Yeah.
The other question I have is, and I mean, I ask why, because it's a puzzle to me, if it's all as pretty much cut and dried as this, is does the government have the money? Have they set aside the money? I don't know if they do. I'd like to see it.
Well, there's a big overrun on the children's
hospital. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's the children, like for some of, I've been in and out of Crumlin for a number of years with the child, and like, your heart would break every single day you go in there. Like the conditions of parents with seriously ill kids. And this cannot go the way of the children's hospital. We have to have learned some lesson somewhere along the way. And a lot of the same tensions have made that project so complicated. You know, a lot of people, it seems to me, are working very hard to try and work on these tensions, to resolve them. It is a very anxious time, and it is in some ways a very difficult time to be making this decision given the year that we've had.
Yeah.
But, you know, there seems to be good intention here on all sides, and I think the will has to hold just until Christmas.
Yeah, by the way, when we were talking about that court case, she said no, that wasn't why she... Why she thought it was happening, because she said if that were so, it would be unconscionable.
The question is why? We don't have the answer. We don't have a convincing answer on the why.
Seamus Coffey, you've been very quiet there. What's your view on this?
That's not a story I keep a very close eye to, and I suppose some of the complexities about who owns what and who's in charge of what is sort of a bit beyond us. But I suppose I tend to agree with Niamh that we have experiences in other areas and you should be trying to see can you get things move forward. I think it's kind of worrying to hear talk, as Irene said, of deadlines approaching before the end of the year for something as important as... Which is like incredibly tight to be doing something that seems to be as complex as this. As regards the overall issue, it's not something I've kept a whole keen eye on.
Right.
But you would like to see it resolved.
Yeah, you certainly would like to see it resolved. And, I mean, when you were talking about the conditions in Crumlin for sick children, I mean, the conditions in Hollis Street are unreal. Mm. I mean, Dickensian, Victorian, all those words spring to mind, you know?
Yeah. And they do their best in a very limited... Yeah. I was saying yesterday, it reminds you of going into an old convent school which I attended myself, but the old small staircases, it's all stone, it's cold, it's not fit for purpose, despite the fact that they do their very best in a very limited fashion.
Yeah. Well, we will move on. As you say, it would be nice if the minister would let us know why it's going up to the wire.
Explain.
Maybe he just trusts the minister. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Now, we will go on to our old pal, Brexit. And I suppose you've written about it, eaten it, drunk it, done whatever else about it, Dennis Dalton, given that you're based in London. What, as you look into your crystal ball, I mean, it seems to be generally agreed that if she goes ahead on Tuesday, and we had the spokesperson on the news headline saying she would, if to go ahead on Tuesday, she's going to lose.
Yeah, you know, Downing Street insists the vote will go ahead on Tuesday. More than 70 Conservative MPs have actually said they are going to vote against this. The DUP are going to vote against it. There are others who have indicated that they're going to vote against it. So she could lose it not by 100, she could lose it by nearly 200 if she went for it. And the problem with these votes is that the less chance there is that it's going to succeed, the less incentive there is for anybody who's wavering
to support,
or for example, for Labour MPs to cross the floor and risk the odium of their own people. So if she holds the vote, you know, it seems that nothing she has done to try to persuade anybody has had the desired effect. And so it would go down very badly. On Tuesday morning, she convenes the cabinet, as always, at 9:30, and the chief whip tends to give a kind of an update on what's going on, and he'll be asked what's it looking like. And if he says that it's going to go down by 150 votes, I would think that if she hasn't already made the decision, that other members of the cabinet will say, if you do go ahead with this, it is doom, not just for your deal, but also for you. And so I think that, you know, what they've been talking about in Westminster and in Whitehall and in Downing Street is looking at various ways in which you could get an amendment which could get a majority support. Because the problem with pulling the vote is that you actually have to get a majority in Parliament to vote for postponing the vote.
Right.
Now, you can kind of walk away from it by just a sneaky thing of not moving the motion that morning, but it's humiliating for a government. So what one thing they're looking at is that you get some amendment which would say Mrs. May is going to go to Brussels and ask for some assurances about the backstop, and that then you'd get a majority to support that, and then you wouldn't have a vote on the main motion. Her honour would be intact. She'd go to Brussels and she would try to get a new deal. But it's not clear they're going to be able to do that. And even if they do, Jacob Rees-Mogg this morning in one of the papers was saying that not holding the vote would be just as bad as losing the vote. She's got to go. And I think there is something of a target on her back now. And what you saw over the weekend, you saw Amber Rudd coming out and saying, and she's an ally of the Prime Minister's, saying, if this deal goes down, we should look at another option, look at Norway plus the customs union. And what people around the Conservative Party say is, if you want to be the successor to Theresa May, you probably want to get out quite quickly after the vote goes down and to say, I've got a plan. This is what we should do. Here are the people who support me. Step off the
stage. So she was putting herself up for inclusion in that consideration.
I think she was putting herself up for inclusion and also promoting the merits of this plan. Because if Theresa May's deal doesn't work, then the options are a no-deal Brexit, and a majority in Parliament is against that. The second option would be to have a second referendum. And then the other option would be this Norway plus, which means that they follow all the rules of the single market and they remain in the customs union, but they have no seat at the table. And the idea among a lot of the supporters of this is that you stay there for a while, and then when you're ready, you kind of move out. But again, there are complications with that one as well. So I think it's both jockeying for position and then also jockeying for these policies. But having said all of that, you know, everything changes. I wrote a piece on Friday morning. I sent it on Friday morning. And actually, by Friday afternoon, I was writing a slightly different one. And so that's what's happening.
Yeah. And in terms of Mr. Varadkar and Mr. Coveney, there seems to be a view here that they've handled all this reasonably well. And yet there's a deep sense of relationships breaking or widening anyway between ourselves and our neighbours.
I think there's that. I think there's also, last week, I think there was a bit of a wobble here in Dublin where some people in the government got a fit of the jitters because you got this report from the Bank of England and about what the immediate impact of a no-deal Brexit could be. And then there was an analysis of the knock-on effects for us. So, for example, if the pound devaluated by a quarter right away, you don't have to be as distinguished an economist as Seamus to work out, you know, what sort of impact that's going to have.
Yeah.
And I think the point is that the government is under pressure to do something to help Mrs. May. And it's probably wiser to do nothing right now. And I think the feeling in Brussels is that you certainly don't do anything before the vote. But also when she comes over on Thursday, it's probably better to listen and wait. But really, the British political convulsion has to work itself out. And the Conservative Party has to work out what it's going to do. And, you know, because otherwise you give some kind of concession in December.
Yeah.
It goes mouldy on an old droopy Christmas tree over Christmas.
Yeah.
And then it evaporates in terms of its efficacy.
Yeah.
And somebody else comes back and looks for more.
Right, OK. Well, Seamus Coffey, of such tremendous distinction. What's your own take on it? You were looking at Colin McCarthy's article today.
Yeah, so he's looking at, I suppose, the constitutional crisis, as he calls it, in the UK, and their, I suppose, experience of referenda over a long period, but having very few of them. They've only ever had three, and two of them voted for no change, so didn't have any impact. And the most recent one, as he points out, is the only one where there actually has been a vote for a change, and it's ended up with a situation where nobody knows what to do. Like, what did the vote actually mean? And we have sort of various challenges over the last couple of years of what the vote actually meant. And Theresa May, for the first 12 or 18 months, said Brexit means Brexit, and we were all wondering, what did that actually mean?
Yeah.
And now they have, at least they have a withdrawal agreement and close to a deal on paper, if they still remain quite a long, long way from actually getting an agreement politically in the UK. Like, Dennis suggests it could be a significant loss on Tuesday. Like, if it was a loss of 150, if she lost lost 70 of her party, lost the 10 DUP and picked up nobody from the Labour side, well, that would be catastrophic all around. I do think it's likely that there will be some Labour support. As while you probably
you do,
there will be some Labour MPs who will cross the aisle and vote in favour, because they'll see the prospect of either A, they want the UK to leave and probably think this could be a reasonable deal to leave, or B, they're Remainers and are looking at what the prospects are in either direction, say, well, we'd like to stay in the EU, but if we're going to leave, this is as good a reason to a basis to leave as any. So I think a loss of 150 is probably a bit excessive, but even if it was 70 or 80, it is a significant loss, and it's hard to know where she goes from here. Like in Ireland, we have, as Colin McCarthy says, sort of a concrete constitution set out. We have a referendum. You know, the constitution changes or it doesn't change. At present in the UK, they don't really know what they're doing. So if Theresa May goes back to Brussels, what is she looking for? Like, we had experience of it. We voted against EU treaties and then we sent the
protocols.
Protocols over, got things attached on defence, on corporation tax. They really weren't part of the treaty, but they placated the Irish electorate and said, look, at least we have got some written confirmation that a certain view holds. But yeah, we're not quite sure what the UK could get if she went back over. So it could be about various different approaches. But like the UK have agreed the current agreement, although the person who was in charge of the negotiations, the minister in the Department of Exiting the EU, resigned pretty much as soon as the cabinet had agreed on the withdrawal agreement that he had agreed. So it's all a bit of a mess.
I noticed that when being interviewed, that both Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney kept on saying, the Prime Minister, the Prime Minister gave her word, the British Prime Minister, and signed up to it. And in other words, it's a deal, and if they don't honour the deal, well, then they're doing the dishonourable thing.
Yeah, and like if you go back to last December, when sort of the principles of the negotiation were set out, in a sense, back 12 months ago, the UK agreed to a backstop in writing as part of the design of the negotiations that took place over the last 12 months. Now we have a deal in place that has the backstop, the avoidance of a hard border in Ireland, and it really would be a huge step if the UK was to step back from all of those commitments it's made over the past 12 months. I think one thing that the confusion over the last couple of weeks has actually emerged is that the prospect of a no deal or hard Brexit has actually reduced. When it comes to the end of March, it looks like something will happen. There'll either be an extension or we'll have this deal, although it appears unlikely at this stage, to be enacted on. But I think the prospect of that hard no-deal Brexit crash out on the 30th of March 2019 has actually reduced over the past while.
Well, I'd say a lot of people hope you're right. This European Court of Justice judgment that will be coming out on Monday at 8 a.m, the significance of that?
It is a question that was posed by the equivalent of the High Court excuse me, in Scotland, which obviously voted to remain. They basically asked, is there a way that the Article 50 could be untriggered, or could we stick things in reverse, essentially? And the opinion that's come out as it currently stands is that, yes, they can undo it. That's going to be formally given by way of a judgment on Monday. It's expected that the answer is going to be that, yes, they can undo, essentially, the triggering
of without the approval
50,
of all the other...
Without the approval of the member states.
Yes.
And that can be done until the withdrawal agreement is formally concluded. So the ECJ, the European Court, has actually rushed through dealing with that case and giving their decision on Monday, obviously with a view to that being beneficial in terms of what the UK ultimately do on Tuesday in terms of clarification of where they're left,
right,
if that needs to become an option.
Right. Mind you, even the mention of the ECJ gets up their nose in Britain.
It does. But actually, I think that you're the legal advisor to the court gave this advice, and generally speaking, the court has to follow that advice. Mm. But I think there is some question in this case that they might add some kind of caveat. So, for example, they would say it has to be in good faith. So you couldn't just decide that you're going to revoke the notice and then a few months later say, we changed our minds again.
Yeah.
And also that there may be, there was some talk in Brussels that we might have a qualified majority of member states. So, which is not in his advice, but that this might be something that...
Yeah, they were trying to prevent a situation where I think rogue countries might trigger the Article 50 just for the crack, essentially, and then decide that we're not really going to go through with it and just to throw the cat amongst the pigeons, essentially.
Right. Well, with the balance going with right-wing and left-wing and Eurosceptics and what have you, all across Europe, that's not, you know, a mad thought, because people could do it. The Michael McDougall piece you were looking at in the Business Post.
Yeah, he was saying, let's not feel too sorry for Theresa May. She's pushing through this, you know, this Brexit plan, and he was saying we ought to support a second referendum. And certainly, as Seamus was saying, the prospect of a no-deal Brexit probably did diminish in the last few days because of an amendment that was passed which will give Parliament a say on what happens next. And so while there is certainly a majority against a no-deal Brexit, there isn't actually a majority in favour of anything else particularly. And so, you know, there is a lot of support growing for a second referendum. But one of the misunderstandings, I think, say, between London and Dublin and Brussels is that the government in London is convinced that Dublin and Brussels would love to go for a second referendum because they think that it would definitely produce a Remain vote.
But that's not necessarily the
case. But it's not necessarily, and it's also actually not true that that's what Dublin and Brussels want. Dublin and Brussels want this deal. They want this thing to be sorted, sorted now, sorted quickly, off you go, goodbye, and wish you the very best of luck. And so and there is a danger that if you do ask the question, that the very asking of the question, we want to ask you to vote again, is a provocation.
And on what? What would the question be is a key issue.
Exactly. Yeah.
What would you be voting on? And if you vote opposed to something, what does that mean you're in favour of? So a second referendum seems attractive, but I think a key issue to set out is what would the question actually be? Would it be Theresa May's deal as it stands now versus a hard Brexit? We'll just go out. Or would it be Theresa May's deal versus Remain? And like that's still to be resolved.
One of the key political economists who predicted a no vote, the first, you know, a vote to leave the first time around, has actually predicted that if they went again, they would go for a second leave, which would it essentially, in some ways, I actually think that the cliff edge, which I think Sadiq Khan referred to this week when he was in Dublin, I actually think it's good. I think it's clarifying minds in terms of the all the bluster around the no deal. But in some ways, actually, I think Dan O'Brien raises some really interesting questions in this in the Indo this week about the bigger questions for us in the long term around what form of Brexit emerges, if it does. And the two areas he highlights, well, there's a couple. The first is security. And he highlights the kind of, I suppose one could say perhaps free riding that has happened in Ireland on security issues because of the balance between the EU and NATO. The second one is the euro and the but the third one, I think it's actually the most interesting, is the kind of soft politics of the EU and the way in which for a long time, actually in the day-to-day cut and thrust of that, often British and Irish civil servants have lined up together, particularly on economic issues, to promote their own interests. And by that particular big beast leaving the stage and walking off, it's going to put, I mean, even I think we're seeing it during the Brexit negotiations with Mr. Varadkar and Mr. Coveney, you know, reconfiguring what are our system of alliances now? Where do we fit in this bigger...
But actually, that's just what you're talking about could feed into a second referendum, because while the Brexit stuff has been going on, people in Britain haven't been looking at Europe. But in a referendum campaign, they would start to look at talk about a European army, about Macron's plans for more Europe. They'd start looking at, you know, so that all kinds of things would happen. But, but one of, if you look at a lot of the polling analysis, if Mrs. May's deal is on the menu at all, either as a choice between that and Remain or that and no deal, or on a preferendum with three options, it's likely to come out on top because it's everybody's second choice. And so you could find that you go through all of this palaver of her deal being rejected, having a second referendum, and ending up with this deal that's on the table now.
Yeah. Eddie?
I suppose that your own remarks a minute ago, wondering at the fact that, or amazed at the fact that the 27 have held together. Okay, and how long can that remain the case? Because not only would it be no deal be a disaster for the UK and for Ireland, but it would be for many European countries. There'd be huge implications for those who export and have huge trade dealings with Britain. So that if it came to it that the Europeans, the 27, had to choose between no deal and no backstop, which would, in other words, Ireland will come back into the frame, you know, because the backstop is not a big deal for them. The implications of a no deal for them would be very significant.
It's a very fair point, and it's one that has been raised by the former Taoiseach as well on the last night at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they're all sitting around there. And if that were the choice, presumably we'd go over the cliff.
Well, that
Yeah, maybe. I mean, at the moment, that doesn't seem to be the way they're thinking, because the backstop, of course, has become a European policy. It's European policy for our benefit. But but what it would mean would be, first of all, unravelling a deal that you'd made with various other people then saying, as a matter of fact, now that we've opened it up, we'd like to talk about fish or we'd like to talk about something else. Yeah. And it's also what you would effectively be doing would be shafting a member state for a state that's departing. And so I think...
But if it's in your own economic
interest, absolutely. And so it's possible that this would happen, but there are also quite powerful forces which are preventing them. And one of them is that they actually do think that if it came to a no-deal Brexit, that Britain would be back pretty quickly looking for a deal because, you know, the effects are so asymmetric. You know, like we're very badly affected. Most other countries are relatively moderately affected by this thing.
And of course, the government continues to say this is a deal, this is it, this is at the centre, and our partners support us, etc.
But I think the other point about a no-deal Brexit from the British point of view is that when you talk to sort of hardcore Brexiteers, they say, oh, it might mean some weeks, some months of discomfort and disruption. We can do it, you know, the Blitz spirit. Britain is a land of Amazon Prime, of Deliveroo. You can order something from Amazon now and get it this afternoon in central London. There is no huge body of opinion that wants is prepared to put up with any, even the mildest disruption. There was a disruption in the O2 mobile phone coverage in London during the week for 8 hours. And Westminster almost went into meltdown. And of course, it was a very real thing. Like, as if you work for Uber, you can't work if your thing is down. But this was 8 hours, one network. And you could still get on if you had Wi-Fi. And yet, people found it almost impossible to function. I just don't think there is an appetite for the Blitz spirit.
Right, OK. Just before I go to the break, I want to talk to you, Seamus. You were given it straight to the government this week in your capacity on the Fiscal Advisory Council.
Yes, I suppose we've had a recent report on the budget that the government put through there at the start of October. I suppose at the outset, I suppose it's important to note that the environment in which we're operating has changed. 7 or 8 years ago, a Fiscal Council would have been talking about problems, 15% unemployment, outward migration, public debt, a huge deficit. Now we're more moving to talk about risks, which I suppose is an issue that many of those problems actually have been addressed, whether through policy, a lot of luck on our side, and maybe the passage of time. But we are identifying risks that are out there, both in the public finances, huge surge in corporation tax that potentially leaves us vulnerable to a reduction there, and maybe also in terms of the economy, issues surrounding Brexit, are we suitably prepared to deal with that? And also the fact that maybe on the upside, we're dealing with capacity constraints again. We've gone from that 15% unemployment rate has become 5%, and perhaps in certain sectors we'll now find labour shortages, and where are we going to find the additional workers required to even maintain growth at a reasonable level? It has been very strong for the last couple of years. We don't think growth is going to keep as strong as it is. In fact, we probably don't need growth to be as strong as it is. Go back to 2002, 2003, we'd come through 6 or 7 years of strong growth. At that stage, we probably needed the economy to slow down, but of course, we had a huge surge in bank lending and a large inward migration that maintained artificially high growth rates for a couple of years. So at present, we are dealing with risks, and I suppose one concern would have been of the recent budget that maybe didn't take those risks sufficiently into consideration, and also seemed to deviate a lot from the plans the government had set out in the summer. The amount of spending that's been introduced for 2018, we've supplementary estimates going through the Dáil now. So a plan was set out and they're 4 or 5% over the plan for 2018 as they get near the end of the year. Health is a big issue there. And the measures introduced for 2019, that we should probably be in a stronger position given the risks that are there. So I think we all have to recognise the improvement that's made, but let's not get complacent about it.
Well, I mean, Pascal Donoghue uses the word prudence very regularly. Do you think it was prudent?
So the most recent budget wasn't. We'd have assessed that changes in and around $3.5 billion for 2019 would have been, which is a significant sum. There's a lot you can do with extra $3.5 billion, and other tax measures would actually have even added to that. So, but the government, as much as we talk about the Minister of Finance, they are government decisions. We do have cabinet responsibility. The government actually introduced a package that was over $1 billion beyond that. So they went for $4.5 billion, which is exceeding what we might consider this normal growth of the Irish economy. We've gone through strong growth. If you want things to be sustainable, you should be looking at your normal growth. So it does exceed that. And there would be concern that if you get a series of these, you get spending increases and tax changes that are difficult to reverse, that if you do get this hard Brexit that impacts the economy, if corporation tax was to fall, if the international trade environment was to change, they could happen individually or they could happen at the same time and compound on each other. We wouldn't be in a sufficiently strong position to deal with those. And what we've seen over the last couple of years is the government has benefited from huge tailwinds. We mentioned that corporation tax has gone from $4.5 billion to near $10 billion. It's actually a part of a commercial report in the Sunday Business Post today. People think it's so interesting that if we sponsor five or six articles on it, people will read the articles and pick up our company. The government, we still have a large debt, $200 billion, but because of ECB policy, of course, interest rates have fallen hugely, yeah, and the cost of that has fallen.
But presumably they're not going to stay down that
low. So and these tailwinds aren't going to be there forever. But the point about the benefits we've had is that the budgetary position hasn't really improved because of them. Like, we're still close to running a balanced budget, which was the target 3 or 4 years ago, before we knew all these good things would happen. So many of the benefits that have accrued have been used either for tax measures or spending measures. So we haven't sort of built up what we'd call fiscal buffers,
right,
to deal with a downturn.
Okay.
And we had the opportunity to do it over the last couple of years.
Right. Yeah. Eddie, you want to come in?
Yeah, I want to say this, that the post-mortem after the last crash, one of the lines in the post-mortem was about the watchdogs that didn't bark. And when they didn't bark loud enough. And I think that Seamus Coffey has done a great service. He's a watchdog and he has barked very loudly. I mean, you asked him a straight question now, was it a prudent budget? And he said no. So there's no beating around the bush on this. And I think it's
I presume Pascal Donoghue would disagree.
Well, Pascal Donoghue represented himself for the last couple of years as Mr. Prudence. And I'm a guy you can trust to be prudent. But that's why you brought up the word. But in fact, he blew it in this particular. And I think he has lost that brand of being trusted. Just to give you one line in the budget, or one line in the promise, if you like, in the budget, that next year, having promised it several other years, there will be a $500 million set aside for a rainy day fund. Now, if you apply that to your own personal finances, Marion, it's like having a €400,000 mortgage and putting aside $1,000 in case you lose your job. I mean, that's what it amounts to. That's the size of the rainy day fund.
The Mr. Donoghue has defended his budgetary policy, saying that he's acknowledged some of the increase in corporate tax receipts this year is due to one-off factors. For next year, this is a quote, my department has taken account of this and has projected a decline in corporation tax receipts for 2019. Expenditure plans have been set on this basis. Niamh, do you check?
Yeah, but I suppose one of my issue with the last two budgets in particular was that if we look at the kind of tweaks that were particularly done around tax, okay, the approach of the department and the minister has very been kind of a little bit for everybody.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So no one group has got a huge amount and there's a little bit for everybody. The problem, from my point of view, first of all, if we accept the fact that austerity impacted on certain people disproportionately, and there are certain people still feeling the effects disproportionately,
without a shadow of a doubt, yeah,
is that the housing crisis and the homelessness crisis put together for key strata groups have actually way negated any of the benefits of those tweaks. Do you know what I mean? So if we look at the escalating prices of rents and house prices, any benefit to the target people in those groups, I mean, there's a very interesting piece in the Sunday Independent today about the whole idea of owning your house and the way that's become a dream for some people. And one of the reasons why it's good is that he takes a particular strata of people, about couples working at a particular income level, and does the maths and shows how for them owning their own home is completely out of reach now. And so therefore, you know, it would seem, personally, I feel that you could have done a lot more in a more targeted way rather than this little bit for everyone, which actually hasn't, in my view, made a huge... Now, the health issue, I know Seamus will... You know, the health overspend is a structural issue. And I suppose that's where, in a sense, the thing of just using corporate corporation taxes so that we don't have to turn off the tap is avoiding the bigger, horrible, discussion that has to be had around health, you know, that we have a service that's both quite expensive and inefficient given what we're doing. That's not going to go away, no matter how much money we have.
But indeed, just referring briefly to Rona Manny's interview yesterday when she talked about the hoops she had to jump through and the groups and management structures to hire a consultant. I mean, it was jaw-dropping. Anyway, I have to earn a few bob for the station, so we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
And thank you very much indeed for that. Now, yesterday, central Paris was practically in lockdown, with tourist sites such as the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre, etc., and businesses along the Champs-Élysées all forced to close. And this was the fourth weekend of protests right across France in the worst unrest to hit the country in decades. Yesterday alone saw 1,700 arrests. Well, with an update, I'm joined by Sophie Pedder, who's Paris Bureau Chief of The Economist. Sophie, how did yesterday play out?
Well, there was a lot of concern ahead of the day that it was going to be as bad as the previous Saturday. So, you know, in some respects, there was a bit of relief that it wasn't quite as dramatic and quite as violent. But, you know, you mentioned the number of arrests. There were still... The city felt like a sort of... It was, you know, in some respects, just there were scenes that you've not seen in Paris really for decades. Police, riot police everywhere, armoured vehicles, not military ones, but riot police vehicles, crowds that were sort of playing cat and mouse with the police, some cars burned. A sense of siege in a way. A lot of shops boarded up that had been shops that had been sort of ransacked the previous weekend, had learnt their lesson, so they were completely boarded up. Cafes shut, museums shut. So it was a very strange sense of sort of a ghost town, but also a city under siege, but less dramatic than the previous weekend. And I think that that's, you know, if you're looking for some sense of, you know, perhaps a trend towards things calming down, it was that the numbers were, there were fewer people on the streets and there was unrest, but it was less excessive and less extreme than the weekend before.
And of course, they won in the sense that the tax hike on diesel was abandoned. And there's an irony there somehow that we talk about climate change and the Paris agreements, and one of the things that's going to arise because of the Paris agreements and because of climate change is that it's going to be very difficult for all of us to have diesel cars and to get cheap fuel. Like, that's an inevitability.
I think this is exactly one of the issues that France is grappling with. You know, we have a president here, President Macron, who was elected on a sort of climate anti-climate change platform, and he has, do you remember the slogan, make our planet great again, which he used, and he has wanted to make the fight against climate change very much part of the identity of his presidency. But it's very difficult because everyone likes the idea of fighting climate change, but nobody likes the taxes that inevitably go with it. And it's very difficult, the problem was, of course, for him that he was hiking taxes on fuel at exactly the time when the world oil price was rising. So the cumulative effect of that was pretty intense for people who are on tight budgets, and that's what really sort of tipped people over the edge, and that's what started the protest. So it is very difficult to get it right. I mean, you have to, the timing has to be right, and there has to be some sort of compensation of, you know, the difficulty in France, of course, was it was people who felt that they were already being sort of overtaxed and hadn't seen anything much in terms of tax cuts, who were feeling that this was, you know, the one tax that pushed them over the edge. So it's very difficult.
It reminds what we had, very complicated things like that over our water charges. I mean, I see the language being used, the straw that broke the camel's back, and that was certainly used here on the water charges. I'll come back to you in a moment, but can I just go to you, if I may, Seamus, because I think this is very relevant. If you take the pain that's going to come with dealing with climate change, and there's no point in pretending that it's not going to be painful. Farmers are going to have to make terrible sacrifices. Fuel is going to get hammered. That means anybody that doesn't live in an area with public transport is going to, and nobody is going to like any of these things. And I mean, they don't like it in France, they don't like it in America, they don't like it anywhere.
Yeah, I suppose something similar happened here in advance of the budget when there was discussion about raising the carbon tax in Ireland, and people were making exactly those points you set out there about the impact of that, and the language seemed to be about mitigating features. Could you introduce a tax on carbon and then have something to offset it on the other side, maybe income supports, other areas that might reduce the impact on the person's overall livelihood, while then changing their behaviour just when it comes to the fuel alone? And it is something that is going to become, I suppose, more important as years go on. But one thing about fuel is that it is going to get more expensive, particularly fossil fuel, because it's going to get scarcer and scarcer, and you have volatility in the price. And while maybe the issue in France sort of was triggered by the whole tax on diesel, I think the movement itself has moved well beyond it.
Right, yeah, well, so I gather, indeed. So if I could go back to you, Sophie. I gather social media played a huge part in these protests.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the accelerated pace at which you can organise things these days. The anger has been around for a while in France, but it was the ability of organisers within a matter of weeks to get together petitions online and using Facebook in particular as a way of organising, so that the numbers came very fast, the organisation took place at record speed, and it really caught everyone off guard, especially in government, because precisely of that speed. And one of the ironies, of course, is that, you know, Emmanuel Macron himself was elected on the back of organising, creating a new party, also in record speed, and also on the back of social media. And so, you know, he is sort of seeing his own techniques now being used against him, because it just makes it all so much quicker to organise, given that that tool is now available.
Now, you wrote the book on Macron. What's going to happen to him now?
Well, it is his first political crisis. And I mean, I don't use that word lightly. It's something where, you know, after 18 months in which he did actually put into place quite a lot of very much needed reforms, and against, you know, protest before, but this is a very different sort of protest. It's not organized. There are no leaders. It's not like those union street protests that you see in France so often. This is something much more amorphous, difficult to handle, it's difficult to talk to anyone about it. You can't negotiate with anyone because there's no one who's prepared to identify themselves as a leader, willing to talk to the government. That makes it very difficult for him. So it is undoubtedly the first real political crisis, and you've seen that in the sense that he's cleared his diary. I mean, his diary has... last week he was supposed to be in Serbia for a couple of days. That was cancelled. Almost every meeting has been cancelled as they try and deal with that. That gives you a sense of how intense the pressure is on him. But, you know, French institutions are strong. He was elected. He has a democratic mandate.
Yeah.
And Parliament is... He has a majority in Parliament. So, you know, we're not looking at a sort of president about to resign, I don't think. But we are looking at one who is going to have to think long and hard about both the way in which he makes policy, and also I think the way in which he interacts with the French. You know, there's a feeling that he's too remote, too aloof, and I think that's something he's probably going to have to think very hard about.
That's an impression you have too, Dennis, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it seems certainly from a distance that it's partly about his style as of governing, and this remoteness and this sense that he is the president of the rich. But I was wondering, I wanted to ask Sophie,
yes.
How do you think, Sophie, this is going to manifest itself in terms of electoral politics? Who stands to gain, or where is it likely to be channeled?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because you've seen during these protests an attempt by extreme or populist politicians, both on the far left and on the far right, to try and sort of piggyback on the protesters, because for them this is a wonderful opportunity to try and exploit the anti-Macron feeling out there. But what's so interesting about the Gilets Jaunes protesters is that they don't want to be but they didn't want any politicians to get involved at all. So you've had Marine Le Pen on the far right, you've had Jean-Luc Mélenchon on the far left, who are being rejected almost because they are seen now as part of the establishment, part of the system, which is a fascinating and new phenomenon. It's not obvious at all that the two of them are going to be the beneficiaries. You know, we are living in at a time of just incredible fluidity in terms of party politics, not just in France, but it's quite other countries. I mean, I think Italy comes to mind, where you saw exactly that happen, the far left and the far right come together.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, at the moment we're right in the middle of that sort of reorganisation, it's not at all obvious that the parties you would imagine would benefit, in other words, the far right and the far left, are going to. This is an apolitical movement that is fed up with party politics and with establishment politicians altogether.
Well, and that seems to be a pattern across the world. Like, if you take the surprise of Brexit or the success of Trump, a lot of these are perceived as protest against old politics, essentially.
But one of the interesting things about the Gilets Jaunes, and again, you see it in Brexit, you see it in Trump, you see it even to a certain extent with the water protests here, is that even though you have the trigger issue of the fuel taxes, there are actually composite movements. So there's a number of different factors. So we talk about Macron's remoteness, we talk about the rural-urban divide in France, which is massive and is getting to be quite significant here as well. And then the whole kind of post-austerity fallout, the particular strata of, you know, the working poor and all those. And it's the combination of those coming together in a particular nexus that creates this kind of fragmentation and social cohesion. And that's what's so interesting about the Gilets Jaunes, is they're very overt about that. That's why they're not talking. They don't want to get back. They don't want to integrate. They don't want to be going under Marine Le Pen's, you know, the fracturing that they want the fracturing, essentially, because that's how they feel. That's representing where they're at. And in a sense, that's the forces that actually we're still seeing even playing out in the UK, and the inability to as you called it earlier, Dennis, a convulsion. This is another convulsion. It's just taking a different form. And that's what's happening all around the world. The cliche all sociologists will say it's neoliberal economic politics. I'm not going to divert from the cliche, but there's no doubt that we're reaching a point where social cohesion is coming under deep strain, I think.
Where do you see matters moving from here? I think it's always very interesting with the French that even if it's inconvenient for them, you will get general support for all strikes. Even if it means, you know, that the metro closes down, the strikers get support. But this is so violent. Is there still that support for them?
Well, I think lots of people expected the support to decrease after the first weekend of violence, for exactly the reason you identify. But what's fascinating is that actually public opinion has stayed behind the Gilets Jaunes protesters, and that's been, and it's a big majority. I mean, it's, depending on the polls, it's sort of two-thirds to four-fifths of French people saying they support the Gilets Jaunes movement.
That's an extraordinary amount, isn't it?
It is extraordinary, and that's really very different from the strikes. I mean, ordinary strikes and ordinary protests, especially over the last 18 months, while Macron's been president of France, actually people have been on his side rather than on the side of the strikes, which has been, which had felt like a kind of new phenomenon. But this, I think the support here is partly because this has become a sort of, not just about the carbon tax anymore, but it's about, you know, the fact that living standards, cost of living, taxes in France, it's a general feeling that, you know, that something's not quite right about the way in which, the benefits or otherwise of the changes that are going on in the world are not being fairly distributed. And I think the French feel that there's a lot of sympathy for people in that situation.
Can I come to you, Dennis? Because I know that you were in Germany for so long for the Irish Times. Is that same convulsion happening in Germany?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly you obviously have difficulties in the German political system because the weakness of the Social Democrats, the rise of the far right. But still, there you don't see that same kind of level of unrest or of general unhappiness, I think. You know, obviously the economy is doing well in Germany. There's still, you know, there are difficulties there, but I don't think they're on the scale or of the intensity that we're talking about here.
Sophie, where to now? I mean, what can Macron do? He's done the U-turn. That hasn't really had any material effect. And when is the next time he'll be tested himself?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult for him. The options are not great. I think there are some things he can do in terms of rethinking tax policy and public spending. He said he wants to have sort of consultations over the next few months in which people participate. There is some form of input from citizens, from the ground, from grassroots organizations in terms of thinking about how French tax cuts or otherwise should fall, and that's one thing. But I think it's also more difficult for him in a way because it's to do with style and it's to do with the way he is, the sort of president he is. He wanted to be this almost De Gaulle-like figure, you know, who it's almost monarchical as well, that sense of France wanting a leader who is strong and projects this sense of grandeur and all of that, which is up to a point true, but I think the French have felt that that went hand in hand with this remoteness, and he's got to address that. I don't think he can connect again with people and try and restore the credibility that he had unless he addresses that issue as well. And the next test for him, of course, is the European elections next May. And that is going to be very difficult. And it's there's even talk at some point of whether the Gilets Jaunes themselves might stand and create some sort of a party. But, you know, we're a long way from that, I think. But you never know. Things can move very fast. But in any case, that vote will be very difficult for him. It will probably turn into a bit of a sort of referendum against or against his presidency.
Ed, do you want to come in on that?
No, I just wanted to say that the social media achieves two things. One is it also enables a movement to be subverted. And there is a piece in The Independent today, the woman, quote is, the woman behind the yellow jackets, that's the woman who started it off, says the revolt has been hijacked. And that the level of violence this time is qualitatively different than the typical French protests, stopping the metro and air travel and so on. So there's something much, much more sinister, she's alluding to, behind the scenes, men dressed in black, organised and being ultra-violent in this case. And it'd be interesting to see, I'd be interested as to what is the public reaction to that element. Are people really supporting the level of violence in this case?
Sophie?
No, I think it's important to make that distinction. People are not supporting the Gilets Jaunes, the violent elements, and there are certainly, the police say that there are infiltrators both on the sort of ultra left and on the ultra anarchist, and they're on the ultra right, or some neo-fascist groups have been infiltrating the movement as well, particularly last weekend. But I think people make a very clear distinction between the sort of justification and the valid protests of people who are standing out there in the cold on roundabouts across France with fires burning and just wanting to make a peaceful protest. Those are the ones the French support. It's not the violence. But what's interesting is that despite that violence, people haven't, the support hasn't reduced, because
right.
I think people make that distinction. And as for the Gilets Jaunes themselves, I mean, you know, you mentioned one of the women who was behind some of the early attempts to get people to together. There is a huge problem with who was behind it, who is a leader, who isn't. There are a lot of internal divisions. There was one group of Gilets Jaunes who were happy or in principle to come and talk to government, and there was even a meeting organized with the Prime Minister with them. And then because they got, some of them got death threats from other Gilets Jaunes about the idea of even talking to the government, they then all pulled out of that meeting. So there's a lot of internal rivalries, and it's a completely unstructured movement with all the rivalries and internal sort of divisions that involves. So it's been both its strength, but it could also be its weakness.
Right. You expect it to continue on much longer?
I think that the protests themselves, the protesters are still out there on the roundabouts, during the week, and we will. They are talking about continuing all the way up till Christmas. We'll see how the week turns out. I think it will be, Macron is expected to talk to the nation in some form or other, and that will also matter. Whether or not there's anything he can say is a different question, but there is no sense that they want to fold their movement yet.
Right.
I think it's they're pretty determined to keep going all the way till Christmas.
Okay. Listen, thank you very, very much indeed. And that was Sophie Petter, who is Paris Bureau Chief of The Economist. Back after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme. We're coming to the end of a year that's seen two changes to our constitution, the repeal of the Eighth Amendment following a vote in May and the removal of the definition of blasphemy as an offence. And now there are more constitutional changes on the horizon, with the government planning a divorce referendum in May next year and a few others yet to be decided. Well, I'm joined in studio along with our other guests by Dr. David Kenny, who's Assistant Professor of Constitutional Law at Trinity College Dublin. First of all, you're very welcome indeed.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about the question of divorce. Mm. That used to be a big convulsion.
Yes, yeah, two big referendums in the 1980s and then 1990s on this question. Very bitter, very divisive, often some very high feelings on both sides and some sort of legendary slogans like hello, divorce, bye-bye, daddy, and so on, designed to play on people's fears of family breakup and so on. And so it seems like we're revisiting this issue. The government says they're planning to hold a referendum in May in principle, but they haven't decided, I believe, whether or not just to propose reducing the amount of time you have to wait for a divorce, or in fact taking out the constitutional restrictions altogether.
Because not unlike the abortion referendum, there was a lot of information beforehand, and it was a very tightly run thing.
Yeah.
About what kind of divorce it would be and how it would operate and how long you'd have to be separated.
Absolutely. In the end, that referendum in 1995 was less than 10,000 votes separated the sides. It was 50.3% in favour. It was a tiny, tiny margin. And so, presumably that was only because of these restrictions that sort of, made divorce quite difficult to obtain. So you have to have been living separate and apart for 4 years of the previous five by the time you're applying for divorce. There has to be no prospect of reconciliation between the spouses, and you have to make proper provision for any spouse and child of the marriage.
Yes.
And so those are the restrictions that are in the Constitution. And if we want to change those, if we want to bring that period down, if we want to change anything about the proper provision clause, so on, that requires a constitutional change. So one of the changes that Josepha Madigan was originally proposing was bring the waiting period from 4 years down to two. So make it a little bit quicker for people to reach the point where they can obtain a divorce. But people have asked, if we're going to the people, if we're having a referendum, might we now be in a position where we don't need constitutional controls on divorce, where we can just put whatever restrictions we want in law and let the Oireachtas decide what the best divorce law is? And maybe that would save another referendum in another 20 years if people felt that the constitutional regime was still too restrictive.
Yeah. Generally speaking, lawyers hate things going into the Constitution in detail.
This is one where I'm actually very much in favour of the reduction of time. So as well as doing criminal law, I have first-hand experience of family law as well. The reality is for a couple to be living separate and apart for the last 4 out of 5 years, people have moved. We move at such a different pace now to when that referendum was held. people in practice turn up on the day of their divorce, a lot of the time in actually very amicable situations, whereby they can often, they come together, or they have their new partners, or they have new families. Like 4 or 5 years is a very significant period of time for people to move on. And this is looming over them before they can have the finality of being able to move on. There is a precursor, there's a judicial separation that can happen. But really, what, and I shouldn't be saying this because I'm doing myself out of a fee, but what happens essentially is when you go for judicial separation, which is a much shorter time frame, it tidies up an awful lot of the legalities of things in terms of proper provision and the housing and the finances and the children and the access. And really then, by the time the 4 or 5 years comes, it's a rubber stamping exercise. Now, some things can change. I don't want to totally eliminate it. But really, the mechanism for judicial separation is one where people are spending fees to get judicially separated, only then to spend more fees to get divorced and have this literally looming over them for 4 out of 5 years, which can prevent them just from moving on with their lives. And often, you know, it can add to some bitterness for some people. And
society, I mean, may have changed as reflected in the outcome of the two referendums, the two standout referendums, I suppose I should say. But there's still an awful lot of keenness for family values and, you know, they're Catholic people. I don't blame the church on this at all, but people's own beliefs and they don't like undermining the family.
But you don't have to have that in the Constitution. You
know, exactly.
You can have family values without having any of these elements. And it, would it be fair to say, David, that our trend constitutionally is to remove these things from the Constitution?
Yeah, I think there's been a realisation that perhaps we were overly keen sometimes to put things on a constitutional level. Divorce was banned in the Constitution when it was written in 1937, so that's been a process of relaxing. But we've seen with the Eighth Amendment that when we insert, you know, very complicated moral and social issues into the Constitution, they can be very complicated consequences that you don't foresee. And even supporters of the spirit of that amendment would probably admit that it had consequences and effects and court cases that people didn't anticipate in the 1980s when that was being written. And so I think there's probably a trend in realising that the Constitution's complicated. You give power to judges and courts to make decisions about what the clause means, and that can create uncertainty and unpredictability, and it takes the power away from the people to lobby politicians to get things changed. We have to go through this long and cumbersome process of amending the Constitution, which can take years to get off the ground. So I think there's a trend to put things in law rather than the Constitution if we're comfortable with that.
Yeah, there's another fear, though. Very often we're quite good at voting about something altogether different in a referendum. Certainly we did it in the European referendums a couple of times. Once it was completely about abortion. I can't remember what the other one was. Or maybe just to give the government a clip in the ear.
Yeah, that's definitely a phenomenon. And you know, there was one great poster in the same-sex marriage referendum where it was, 2015, vote for equality, 2016, vote against austerity. Like, don't take your anger on the government out in this referendum. Please wait till next year, you know. And that's, I think, reflective of something that does happen in Irish referendums. And there was always a sort of a suggestion that the presidential age referendum, which was run alongside same-sex marriage, almost gave something that people could vote against, you know, if they were looking to vote no on something, you can vote no on that. And I'm not sure if that's, you know, the reason for that referendum or not, but that was mooted as a possibility because no one seemed to want to campaign for that referendum and it failed by a massive margin. So when people are unhappy or angry about
things, you have to give them something to say no to.
Well, no, I don't necessarily think that. I think that there's a perception perhaps that you can get an anti-establishment vote, and if the government, as they often are, almost always are, proposing the amendment in question, there's a fear that the government supports, the government is not popular, but could come out.
But that hasn't. I mean, that's always happened with the European ones, but partly because Europe is about everything anyway.
Yeah.
And but it doesn't tend to happen, does it, on those sort of issues? I mean, certainly the recent ones, they were very focused. I don't think most people who voted on those were voting on anything else.
Well, maybe the people that were campaigning for the same-sex referendum, I mean, there'll be book. Well, there have been books written about how brilliant they were in their campaign. Mm. Whatever about your point of view, that in the way they campaigned, it was very clever. Mm.
I think that the Senate referendums and the Oireachtas Inquiries referendums are interesting ones, because there you did have perhaps a sense of the government was proposing reform, the government had sort of some trouble with popularity and austerity at those times, and there was a sort of an unexpected swing against those measures when actually the underlying measures are quite popular. People still support more inquiry of powers to the Oireachtas in general. The Seanad is not terribly popular as an institution overall, and yet we saw those referendums fail. So I think you can have, particularly on political reform questions, a suspicion perhaps of
right.
government proposals.
Now the second one on, and which do you think it will be, to reduce it to 2 years or to take it out altogether?
I think it probably depends on the reaction of other political parties. I think the government has sort of said it's going to consult people. I suspect if there's any serious pushback, we might just keep it to taking out 2 years rather than opening up the bigger question of proper provision and so on. But if there's broad support for that, we might get the broader question.
Okay, now the second one.
Yes.
Is an interesting one, and this is to do with it's been mooted so many times about the diaspora being allowed to vote in presidential elections.
Yeah.
Explain to me how that would work.
So this would be a proposal to sort of basically separate out the block of voters for presidential elections. At the moment, the same people who vote in Dáil elections vote in the presidential election. It's constitutionally linked. And so what the government has proposed to do is give the sort of Irish diaspora, Irish people living abroad, votes in presidential elections, but not in Oireachtas elections, in Dáil elections. And so essentially to do that, they have to change the constitution to separate out those two electorates, to have a separate electorate for the presidency and for the Dáil. So that's why it's going to referendum. That's why we'll have a vote on it, because there has been this desire to have emigrant voting, but a reluctance perhaps to extend that as far as Dáil elections, perhaps because of the financial implications of the Dáil has spending powers and so on, and people associate that with taxation and people residing.
Representation and taxation.
Yes.
Yeah, going hand in hand. Would there be a cut-off, in the sense that would it be generational or would it be in terms of years?
Yeah, that would be an interesting question. I mean, in terms of the constitutional change, the easiest thing, again, might be to sort of have a clause saying that, in principle, all Irish citizens, unless otherwise restricted by law for being outside the country for some amount of time, are eligible to vote. And if the government wants to set a time limit, the way I had sort of understood the proposal being discussed, it seemed that citizenship might be, of itself enough to entitle you to a vote in a presidential election. The presidency perhaps being seen as a symbolic sort of value-laden institution, perhaps it's a way of including diaspora in that expression of national values, but not giving them a huge direct say in Irish politics, in practice. I think that's the proposal, but we'll have to see what language is ultimately put forward to insert into the constitution.
Yeah, but if you talk about citizenship, if you have a granny,
yes.
You're talking across generations.
I think it's a terrible idea. Particularly the idea of separating them, in the sense that, because a lot of other countries do allow people who live abroad to vote, and they generally do have restrictions. I think in the British case, it's up to 15 years. And so, but what that is saying is that you are still part of this society and community.
Yeah.
And so those issues that you raise about spending. So if we are part of the community for the presidency, we ought to be part of the community for everything else. Mm. But it makes no sense, it seems to me, to separate them. It's purely gestural.
But the office of the president is so important. It's way too important to be using to make this gesture, precisely because it is symbolic. There's very few ways in which the president can actually communicate to ordinary people, and it's largely through symbol and gesture.
But if you remember Mary Robinson, she was the first that made a very big issue about emigration and the candle in the window and all of that. Like, those who had emigrated appreciated it so much.
They did,
because
Marian,
they still have their Irishness.
They do, but you see, in the citizenship referendum, we changed the basis of citizenship in Ireland. In some ways, it's quite a loose definition now, but it's one that's based on blood relationship, essentially. And that can be very far out. You only have to look at Donald Trump and the absolute cabal of Irish Americans that surround him in the White House right now.
And now you're not very proud of that.
No, I'm not. But what I'm saying is that, if we look at, say, Ireland in the last 8 years, just since 2010, and we look at the amount of change that has occurred for people who actually live here experientially, and that change is then then reflected in when they go out and vote for president. And it, you just don't experience it the same way if you don't live here. And I think there are other ways to make those kinds of gestures.
Seamus?
Yeah, so I think one issue to address is that we'll have the European and local elections next year, that there's people who can vote in those who live in Ireland who are not able to vote in our Oireachtas elections. Yeah. And those people, I think, are much more entitled to a vote in the Oireachtas and the presidency than people who are abroad. And expanding the franchise to them would be better. Because when it comes to it, those people who live in Ireland and can't vote in our Oireachtas elections actually have no vote in any legislative election in the main unless their own country grants it to them in a country they don't live in. So they can vote for relatively inconsequential positions from a legislative perspective at local level and at European level, but actually when it comes to national level, there's people living here who don't have a vote. So if I think there's something to be addressed, it's actually that, giving those people the vote, not dealing with people who don't live in the country at all.
I'm looking at it from a slightly different perspective, Marianne, in that I have two siblings who are away. So my eldest sister is out in New York. She's between New York and San Francisco. She utilises her Irishness and her diaspora title massively. She's very much engaged with the Irish-Canadian aspects of things, the Irish-American Fund, all of those. She is much more of an asset to Ireland abroad than she would be here. My brother similarly lives out in San Francisco. They're as much every bit, if not more, I would say, linked and rooted in Ireland, even though they're not physically here. So I'm looking at it from a slightly different perspective. I think they would absolutely embrace and rejoice in the fact if they had some form of, you know, postal
tangible
vote,
yeah,
tangible vote, because, and I can say particularly my sister, who's very, very heavily involved in terms of bringing business back to Ireland. She's very involved in the communications end of things through banking. She has plugged for jobs to come to Ireland through the IDA, all of that. She does more for Ireland out there than she ever does here. And yet she is as Irish to the core as I am sitting here, and I'm living in Termonfeckin. So for her to be completely cut off from having an input in terms of anything that happens here, I think is unfair, because a huge amount of our diaspora actually do an awful lot of work that goes unrecognised for the country.
Well, funnily enough, that was one of the issues that Mr Casey raised in the presidential election. And there are other countries that are very good at doing that.
There are very effective honour systems ways, though, of recognising that kind of work. And France in particular has a good one. There's a number of other countries who have ways of recognising precisely and honouring that kind of work.
Eddie, can I just ask you before we go?
No, just very briefly, I think that it varies. You have people like your sisters in America, in San Francisco. Most of my siblings live abroad, but they have no interest in Ireland.
Right.
You know, to give them their lives. So to give them a vote, they may well But the other thing on the divorce, and the divorce one, talking about amicable separations, I have a friend who had a divorce party with her husband and all the friends were invited. Very amicable.
Okay. Yeah. And the third one, we'll have to give this less time.
Yes.
The third one is, of course, leave women to the end, yeah?
Yes, this is the women's place in the home as it's known, or the sort of the clause saying that women shouldn't be forced by economic necessity to leave the home and pursue economic activity.
Neglect
of the duties in the home, yeah. And so this has obviously long been discussed. I think there's been 7 now domestic reports about whether or not we should do away with this clause.
You can't do without a report.
You can't do without a report. And so the government was proposing to run it at the same time as blasphemy, just to remove it. And various groups sort of objected to that on the basis there should be a clause inserted, you know, recognising the work of carers. So we've had an Oireachtas committee report on it last week, and they suggested we might either sort of insert a symbolic recognition of carers, or we might have another sort of citizens' assembly to discuss this again and maybe discuss putting in a special socioeconomic right for carers or something. So it looks like we could have yet another process, more discussion, another report before we actually vote on that one.
Okay, bring them on, as they say, bring on the reports. It's good for business for you guys.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Reports, tribunals, bring them on.
thank you very, very much indeed, David. And we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, there's a new film coming out in January called Stan and Ollie, which takes us back to the golden age of cinema, the time of Laurel and Hardy, as they were better known, and of black and white movies. And I'm joined by producer Bill Hughes, he of Mind the Gap, who has recommendations for black and white films to watch over the Christmas holidays, which sounds like a lovely idea. Why do we get kind of all gooey and warm about black and white movies?
Because it's almost like somebody introduced you to the concept of a library. It's like if you don't know what a library is and you go and get a book, if you don't know what black and white movies are, it's like you don't know movies. You need to educate yourself and you need to marinate yourself in good black and white movies to just enjoy them and enjoy the stories that are being told, because modern movies are all influenced or all informed by what the great directors in the golden era of Hollywood did in black and white.
Right.
And in the UK and what they did in black and white. And black and white images are just so classic. And what's great about black and white movies is the sparkling scripts. These days it's all about CGI and special effects, and if there isn't a car chase and at least 40 killings, it's not a movie.
This is
Whereas,
true.
You know, when a good reputation is being savaged behind its back in a black and white and somebody's sneaking in and out of the shadows, I just love that. And that's more like real life. That's more like what we're all going to encounter. And, you know, the bitchiness of a good one-liner can't be ever underestimated, because then you can carry that into your own life and use it on somebody as well. You know?
Should you so wish. That's very interesting what you say. There was less violence, wasn't there?
There was so much less violence. And it's really funny because in 1980, when Martin Scorsese was deciding to make Raging Bull with Robert De Niro, that movie, he knew in his head the boxing scenes were going to have to be incredibly gory. And so it was going to be blood and guts, and that would put a lot of the audience off. So he made the decision to make it in black and white. And so it's not remotely as... Now, the intensity of getting punched in the face and the intensity of the glove hitting the jaw and all that sort of stuff, it's there, but that's a black and white movie that any man or any boxing fan, and I hate to be sexist in saying man, but a lot of women are boxing fans, but if they want to watch something like that over Christmas... Yeah. No, not you. But really, it's the one-liners and it's the comedy and it's the arch eyebrows and it's all that. And our great heroines, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and, you know.
Start giving me names.
Well, Some Like It Hot.
Oh, terrific.
If people haven't seen that, I want to slap them. Do you know, what are you at?
No violence.
But also the undertone of what it was about. And now, remarkably, that was to be made in colour. But Marilyn Monroe asked, could she see the rushes of the test screenings? And Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis looked so grotesque in the makeup that she said, no, it's going to be so much better in black and white. And they made it in black and white. And so that was, you know, a big decision made. But a film that I think these days, everybody's talking about the Kardashians and all that. If you want to see the origin of the Kardashians, you need to go back to 1939 to a movie by George Cukor called The Women. And it is the original women. It's a play by Claire Booth Luce. It was a Broadway hit, and then Anita Loos converted it into a screenplay. And there are 120 speaking parts in the film because it's all chatter. It's chatter in spas and bars and women's toilets at nighttime and nightclubs, and it's all elegance, and it's Joan Crawford, Joan Fontaine, Paulette Goddard, everybody's in it, and Rosalind Russell.
It sounds glamour,
but
anyway.
They're all talking about men. But there's 120 women, and not one man appears, even in the crowd scenes, even in the street scenes, even in the railway scenes.
Is that not
scenes.
Sexist?
No, it's brilliant. It's so funny. And for some reason, right in the middle of the film, it goes to a colour fashion show for 5 minutes and then comes back to black and white.
Right.
So it is. But the women, just for the script, please
okay.
watch it. You know, find it.
Ooh, some like Casablanca, I presume.
Casablanca, of course.
People are
All
perfect.
About Eve. Yeah. All About Eve with Betty Davis and Anne Baxter. And that's about to be revived in the West End with Gillian Anderson playing the Betty Davis part of Margot Channing, the actress who gets apprenticed by this really manipulative young woman called Eve Harrington, who then tries to take over her life, take over her relationships. And so All About Eve, if you haven't seen it, what are you at? You know?
Right, okay. Rebecca?
Rebecca.
Alfred Hitchcock can be little bit down behind the couch with your eyes.
Yeah, but
covered. Not,
well, Rebecca, it is a psychological thriller, but you've got the incredibly urbane Laurence Olivier as this widower, and it's kind of mysterious where Rebecca, his first wife, went.
Right.
And it seems that it's a secret between him and his housekeeper, the incredible Mrs. Danvers, who, perfect black and white. I mean, she dresses in black. She's in and out of black and white shadows. She's constantly sniffing Rebecca's fur coat and trying to remember what Rebecca was like. And poor Joan Fontaine comes into this and she's like a little lamb to the slaughter. She's no clue what she's doing in this big house and all these people around her behaving weirdly. You got to see Rebecca. But Young right. Frankenstein... Young Frankenstein, Mel Brooks, Madeleine Kahn, got to see that too. So
you're a fan of black and white?
Yes, love them. Yeah, and I try and get my wife to watch things because she hasn't seen really anything. So we're on a project to try and get her to watch a few.
Okay. Where will he start with her?
Well, I think you've already managed to start. We were having a little word outside and he's done Sunset Boulevard, which is incredible. I recommended the Last Picture Show to you.
Yes.
I recommended The Women to you. The Last Picture Show you've got to see as well. And like this.
Okay,
just
can
so
I just
films.
Catch yeah. to come out because people don't all have DVDs anymore.
No.
How did they get them?
Go online, go to YouTube's movie channel, and YouTube's movie channel has these for €3 or €4. You can actually download and watch. You can also go to the IFI, now has its own...
In Dublin.
But the IFI website.
Oh, right.
And they have access as well.
Okay.
But if you want, if you're like me and you're a troglodyte and you want to have a DVD, go to Golden Discs or go to Tower and buy boxes of black and white box sets, you know.
Okay.
They're all there.
Okay, listen, I'm going to have to leave it there, but we will put your Ode to Kill a Mockingbird is in there, separate tables, I remember that.
David Niven.
Loads of stuff there and we'll put the list up. Bill, thank you very much indeed. I gather your Lords and Ladies is moving on.
It's so everywhere. 28 countries now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Listen, thank you very much indeed for that. And thanks to all our contributors on the programme today. Today's show was produced by Rachel Graham. Researchers are Katrina McFadden and Rachel Breslin. Broadcasting coordinator is Bridget Nicholas. On sound, Kieran Dunn. And the series producer is Margaret Curley. That's all from us. As I say, a very good day to you.